Welcome to Two Men in the Middle. This is where two men from the middle of the country talk politics with our boots firmly on the ground in a red state. I am Craig Huey.
I am Brandon Koenig.
And the first thing you'll notice is this used to be Mike, his silky tones, giving you the intro, and now it's me who just butchered that. So the first change in the podcast that you'll notice is Mike's going to take a little bit of hiatus. Mike is running for Congress in the 3rd, as anybody who listens to the podcast knows, and it's just a brutal job. I mean, it's a job and a half, him running for Congress. If you've listened to the last couple episodes, I think we did those early in the morning because that's all the time that Mike had. So Mike needs to take a little bit of a step back from the podcast as he tries to get through the primary season. So Brandon, you're gonna sub in for Mike for a little bit.
Exciting, big shoes to fill. We'll see how this goes.
We'll see how this goes. And you've been to the Capitol before. You were on Senator Jerry Moran's staff. And you know, a political campaign season, it can be tough.
Oh, it's brittle. I mean, it's 24/7 nonstop. Your brain never shuts off. There's always something you have to do.
Yeah. There was, they are talking about, McConnell came out and basically said they were going to suspend the summer recess. And I was amazed that some of the folks were like, you know, well, they don't work very hard. You need to work through your vacation. You've worked directly for a senator. That's got to be a brutal 24/7 job when they're on the Hill.
Oh, it is. Absolutely. And, you know, when they're not on the Hill, I think people just assume that they just come back and just kind of relax when, you know, usually they're out visiting constituents, they're, you know, visiting businesses, they're making the rounds, they're trying to understand the dynamics in their district. I mean, if you're from a large state geographically like Kansas and you're a senator, you're visiting every county in the state, like Jerry Moran does, all 105 counties. And it's a nonstop job. And I think it's easy to lose sight of that with the political rhetoric.
Yeah, looking at, hey, these guys aren't doing their job. They're not putting the hours in. That's why they need to cancel their recess. I don't think that's true. And I think most people who follow politics at all would not wish the schedule that Jerry Moran has to keep as a U.S. senator on anybody.
No, absolutely not. And it's not a 9-to-5 job. No. So even if they have 2 days off in terms of votes during the week, you're neglecting to recognize that one night where they were, you know, till 2 a.m. taking a roll call vote on something, or, you know, an emergency spending bill, or, you know, a continuing resolution, which, you know, we're in that cycle perpetually. So it's a lot of factors involved.
So let's talk about our first topic, North Korea. You know, that summit was the 12th, which was what, Tuesday? It's Thursday today.
Right.
So we've had a couple days to kind of digest what that was. And no matter what it turns out, it was excellent theater and excellent TV at the time. I found the whole thing kind of riveting. I bounced between multiple news outlets. The pageantry of it, if there's one thing President Trump knows how to do, he knows how to put on an event and he knows how to maximize his screen time. Now that you've had a couple of days just to kind of let that roll around in your head a little bit, give me your first reaction or your thoughts to the summit between Kim Jong-un and President Donald Trump.
Well, as you said, a lot of theatrics, and in terms of details, we have none yet.
We do not.
And that's, I think, that's the unknown. I wasn't surprised by, the fact that we came out of that with very little, because it was basically they met for 45 minutes, and you can't really get much from a couple hours in terms of setting that up to end. And, you know, ultimately, there's a lot for the North Koreans to put on the table and to show. Now, we've already made concessions, and that makes me a little bit apprehensive. We immediately decided we were going to suspend war games with South Korea, which is a lot of leverage to concede. And we have this general declaration of denuclearization, but there's no timetables yet. We don't know how the inspections are going to occur, who's going to conduct those inspections. You know, President Reagan said trust but verify. And I think that's something we would do well to remember in this case, and I don't see any examples
of that. North Korea has made this promise multiple times before. I saw a timeline where almost every president has gotten some type of promise out of North Korea to denuclearize rise and some sort of escalation, downward escalation for sanctions relief or something. I really don't see anything kind of on the table that leads this time might be different than the other times that they have, that we've gone through this process with North Korea.
And I think that's what's kind of unsettling. We don't know. There's no indication of that. And I think what we need to watch in the coming weeks, if there's any examples of further concessions that we make, yeah. The Japanese and South Koreans are, you know, very fearful that we are going to move troops out of Japan and South Korea.
Tell me why that's a bad idea.
It's a bad idea because in terms of geopolitics, you know, it's like dominoes. Those troops are basically leverage against any type of preemptive strike by the North Koreans.
True.
It's a bulwark against any type of hostile aggressive action. If you remove those, again, without any preconditions from the North Koreans, you know, it's you lose what leverage you have. Any moves like that that are made have to be simultaneous with a move on their part. Something concrete in terms of saying they're going to de-escalate on their side.
So we've been in Korea now for 60, 70 years. The Korean War, I think, ended in 1953. It's 2018. Math isn't my specialty, but that seems like a really long time. And we're defending against a North Korean nation and North Korean army. We're defending against a nation that literally can't feed itself. That's starving itself under its leadership every year. One of the criticisms of our military is we get into a conflict and we stay. There's never an exit strategy. We've got pockets of military presence everywhere, from World War II, from Korea to the Middle East. I guess I understand what you're saying. I think there's some validity to it, but it also feels like there's a real kind of desire to, why do we still have, what is it, 50 or 100,000 troops in South Korea? If the Korean Peninsula wants to unify and really unify under Chinese rule, almost basically, why is that something that we still care about?
Well, and the short answer to that is because technically there was never an armistice signed. War True. Never was declared over. And so technically the Koreas are still at war. And, you know, the threat of hostility breaking out at any given point is a real fear. So I think that's what you have to look at. I think that denuclearization, I can understand the push for that, and absolutely that must take precedence. You know, even more so in terms of the human rights record, so we can get to a point where there's stability on the Korean Peninsula. But again, we need to be extremely cautious about making concessions and multiple concessions before they acquiesce and also make do, because I think that's what gets us into a world of hurt. And I want to add that many Republicans are giving Trump a lot of credit for this meeting taking place.
It's a love fest now.
And, you know, people have very short memories, because all of the past presidents, if you go back to Clinton, Bush, Obama, they all had the opportunity to have unilateral talks with North Korea, and they turned that down because U.S. policy has always been in favor of multilateral talks with preconditions. We were never going to sit down unilaterally without South Korea and Japan at the table, and without China, and without preconditions. We've done that now, which, if you're okay with that, then fine, but that goes against longstanding U.S. policy for the past 50 plus years, and it goes against longstanding Republican policy. Yeah. When it comes to
really
diplomatic
China's
relations.
China's going to dictate if this succeeds or fails.
Absolutely.
China can at any point in time decide we're going to fully fund North Korea, and any sanction we or the UN or the global community puts on them is irrelevant. And I don't think there's any way China is going to allow an expansion of the United States military presence on the Korean Peninsula, that they are not going to allow the Korean Peninsula to reunite and have America be the driving force behind that.
No, that's not going to happen. That's why it's even more critical that we think very deliberately about withdrawing forces, because I think that it's going to be much more difficult to put those forces back. And China has the ultimate leverage, because whenever we've implemented sanctions and implemented tougher sanctions, China has responded by assisting North Korea and offsetting, neutralizing the impact of those sanctions.
China's not going to let North Korea completely fail. They're not going to do it. They're going to prop them up in a way that they can feign some support to the international community. They can condemn Kim Jong-un for the absolutely horrible human rights violations that he is. They're going to put some distance between them. But North Korea to China is kind of like their really goofy cousin.
Yeah.
You know, they're part of the family.
I was going to say redheaded stepchild.
Redheaded stepchild, yeah. Goofy cousin. They're kind of in the same family.
It's an awkward position.
It's
because
a very awkward position.
They can't afford for North Korea to go too rogue and cause, you know, a major international incident. They would have to rein them in.
They would have to respond to
but
that.
But it's in their best interest to have North Korea as a check.
Absolutely.
On
but they're
the
also
United
not
States.
Going to have North Korea, South Korea, and the United States sitting at a table negotiating a peace treaty that increases our sphere of influence on the Korean Peninsula.
No, I mean, absolutely not. And that's why the idea of multilateral talks that included the Chinese were always key to making any kind of progress with the North Koreans.
China, in my opinion, China would completely bankrupt and destroy North Korea before it would let the two Koreas unite, led by the United States. I think that's how strongly they feel against that.
Oh, absolutely. It's a threat to them right on their front door, they're not going to allow that.
So now that's a few minutes of serious talk about the North Korea thing, now let's just talk about the president, his presence. And if you watch that thing, there were some really odd moments. There were some odd moments in Singapore. There were some odd moments in the media coverage of it. And now that he's back, there's been a variety of just weird things that have been said, that have been presented. To your point, Republicans kind of want to cozy up to this, but they also know this can fall apart at any point. Nobody knows what was said. Nobody knows what was signed. So there's that feeling like they want to put one toe in the water, but extremely cautious about this is Trump. This was done very quickly. Nobody knows how this is gonna end. Give me from a theater standpoint, what stood out to you as what made you kind of scratch your head or say, wow, I didn't think I would see that? Or what were some of the most bizarre moments of this thing?
Oh, there's so many. And so I think the apt analogy here is if your, you know, girl and guy are out and have like a drunken night out weekend in Vegas and decide to get married on the fly at a Vegas wedding chapel, have it discuss long-term commitment, have it discuss the specifics in terms of how it's going to work and, you know, compatibility. And then, you know, the morning after, you know, everybody is kind of scratching their heads trying to figure out, what did we actually do?
You wake up, you roll over, you're naked, you got a ring on your finger. And you can see somebody next to you, but it's like, I don't even want that person to roll over because I have no idea what we just did.
Exactly. I feel like that's how many of us as Americans are kind of looking at that.
Well, with this, I heard that take them completely denuclearizing could take up to 10 years. And, you know, they have, you know, 36 to 56 existing nuclear weapons. They have hundreds of sites that are development sites. This is not something, to use your analogy, that you realize, oh, crap, this was a huge mistake. Let's get this annulled and go about our business.
No.
Once you wake up and you realize, we did this, or we think we did this, now you've got this very long process to put in place to try to get anything positive to come out of this.
Well, and the problem is we don't know what we don't know. This is a hermit kingdom. Yeah. Many of these sites, we don't even know where they are or they exist. There's ones that we know about. There's others we don't, because they haven't had inspectors in the country in so long. And I think that's going to be the sticking point, is who are they going to allow in? What type of access are they going to give?
Yeah.
And that's ultimately going to determine whether or not this is successful, because we can't trust based on word alone. That's
so you said, you're, as a Republican, that there's a side of you that, yes, this is the Republican president. This is something that has some potentially positive. So you're looking for ways to kind of cozy up to this and say, okay, here's one possible way where this could be positive. As a Dem, I could easily just take a shit on this and say, this is Trump at his worst. This is him being him just jumping at something. He did something that any other American president could have done before him, but had the good sense not to. This just proves every bad instinct about Trump. At the same time, watching this, the coverage of it, I thought the best thing that came out of this was Kim Jong-un actually traveled to another country. He traveled to a modern country. He's been to he went to South Korea. He's been to Singapore. People have come to see him. Maybe the biggest benefit of this is just getting that guy who really doesn't travel out of the country. I think he's been the leader there for 6 years, and he's left the country five times. And I think four of them were to China. So, I mean, again, maybe the benefit of this is just getting him out into the world a little bit, letting him see a modern society in a modern city like Singapore. Maybe that has more of an effect on him than anything.
Right. Well, and we know he loves American culture. I mean, he's, you know, fanatic about Dennis Rodman.
Oh, my
we
God.
Know that he...
Did you see Rodman crying?
I did. That was bizarre. And I had to remind myself, I'm like, is this reality?
Rodman is going to run as Republican for something in the next 4 years.
He's already on his way there with the MAGA hat and
My God.
But you know, I think the thing to remember with Kim is he consumes American entertainment. So there, on one hand, you have this dynamic where he loves American entertainment consumerism, but at the same time, he has instilled this hatred of America, you know, and within the country.
Yeah.
And so, how do you reconcile the two? Now, the other thing you have to keep in mind is that the North Korean economy is in shambles. So it is in Kim's best interest to do whatever possible to get rid of the sanctions and bring the economy back, because dictatorships tend to fall and insurrections occur when economies go south and when eventually it reaches a tipping point and rebellions happen. But ultimately, he's, I think, most interested in self-preservation.
So I think so.
That supersedes, you know, democracy. It supersedes, you know, democratic norms or, you know, modernity in terms of what the rest of the world does. And so he might be willing to adopt some of that. But at the end of the day, he wants to survive. And he wants his dynasty to survive.
I think one of the things that struck me was, and there was a group of reporters on one of the big cable networks who talked about in a visit to North Korea, they had visited the Museum of American War Atrocities and how much it has been beaten into every Korean about what we did during that war, the crimes that we committed, how evil America is, and that we are, since the Korean War, we have been every day plotting to overthrow, to eliminate the dynasty that's there. And there's really nothing about us to trust. That's a huge culture shift that's going to have to happen if Korea is going to unite with South Korea and some sort of Western-style democracy is going to take hold. The people of North Korea have no history of that. They have no education of it. And that just seems like a real long shot.
Well, and from the time they are in grade school, North Korean children are taught that the United States is the great Satan. Yeah. And it's through the television programming, through the education there. And I think the disconnect you have, and I'd be really curious to see how North Koreans react, because they live in constant fear because they've been told that the United States will bomb us at any given second.
Yeah.
And that we're under constant threat of missiles being lobbed at us by the United States. And then here they have their leader, you know, laughing and smiling and, you know, shaking hands with, you know, the leader of the free world. And so, you know, what type of reaction does that engender? If you're a North Korean, you've been taught to hate the United States your entire life, and now things are suddenly different. You know, what does that mean for them?
I liked my favorite quote or my favorite story to come out post-summit. And you may have seen this. In an interview, Donald Trump said that thousands of parents whose sons died in the Korean War, talked to him during the campaign and asked them to bring their sons' remains home. The Korean War ended in 1953. Yeah. If your son was drafted or went to war at 18, you would be 101. They would be 101. Basically, that's just a lie. That's just something he made up. And it's just, again.
Well, there were so many quotes that came out. There was an article that profiled like the top 30 quotes out of that meeting. The one that I liked the best was the one where, and I have to give him credit for being brutally honest, but where Trump admitted, he's like, I could be completely wrong about this, but I'll never admit it if that's the case.
Yeah,
I'll make
absolutely.
Something up.
he's got to the point now, and this is where we at some point, we'll have to sit down for like 3 days and hash this out. But casual lying is just acceptable now from the American president.
Oh, we shrug
It's like a five-year-old who comes in with chocolate in his face. Did you eat the candy? No, I didn't. And we just let that go now. Nobody even calls him out anymore that President Trump, that is so not true that thousands haven't come up and talked to you about this. If you go through that list of 30 quotes, and what's weird is something embedded in something as important as this summit, we just truth honesty, what really happened, we just kind of shrugged that all off and said, you know what, with this guy, there's really no way of knowing it. So we'll just have to move forward and see what happens.
Well, we've lost expectation that Absolutely. We're going to be told the truth. And we've come to accept that as a new normal. And that gets back to the idea that no, none of this is normal. And that's not, and that never has been the yeah. norm if you go back, you know, multiple presidents. And we just move on. And part of that is just because there's so much, and that's a strategy too, muddy the water, you know, throw everything Absolutely. Out there. You can't focus on something like the truth when it comes to statements being made in the context of yeah. unilateral talks because, oh, we're going to throw this out here and now the news is moving on to this. There's literally so much to consume. You can't stay focused on that or investigate that or go back to yeah. that.
And you're right. It happens so fast. Why I can't go back even 3 days because so much has happened in that same vein since then. It's like we even forget it. So there was one summit with the President of the United States talking to, by all means, one of the by any measurement, one of the still most ruthless dictators in the world. I mean, anybody that spent any time studying or knows anything about North Korea, it is a hell on earth style place. And he met with a man who killed his own brother, his uncle. This is a guy who killed his stepbrother or his partial brother by like a VX gas attack in a Malaysian airport. He allegedly Right. feeds people to dogs. He starves his own people.
Well, and let's not forget that there are internment camps in North Korea. If absolutely. You know, speak out against the regime or commit a political crime, you and your family and your extended family Yes. are thrown into these internment camps where you live out the rest of your lives. There's stories of women giving birth in these camps and their children grow up and die in these camps yeah. and are never let out to see the light of day.
So the President of the United States met with that individual. And right. then in the same week, he met with the G7. And the G7 is supposed to be our closest economic allies, and they're supposed to all be democracies. They're the countries that are our closest kind of allies and are supposed to resemble our values.
Market democracies, also usually the world's largest economies. And so the idea is to present unity. We have shared values that go back, you know, over multiple generations.
Absolutely. These are our cousins in our family, but these are like the same cousins.
Right.
Like everybody has the cousins you like go on vacation with and the cousins you never talk to. These are the ones we go on vacation with. The president also met with them and that turned into a shit show very quickly.
Exactly. That went downhill. You saw the tweets that came out of that.
Yeah.
And I think one of the most damaging aspects was the fact that this communique was signed. And we thought that everybody was in agreement. And then the president decides Absolutely. He's withdrawing his support, which is a major blow to the unity of this group. And granted, you know, the other leaders around the table have been around long enough and know that it's going to be difficult to find common ground with this president on a host of issues, particularly yeah. trade issues. And they've resigned themselves to that. But I think that what we saw was just the level of disagreement. I mean, you have the American president out there openly, you know, complaining about having to go to Canada to participate yes. in this, that he doesn't want to be there.
Yes.
I mean, you're setting the stage for a disastrous meeting to begin with. And then you pile on the fact that the president wants Russia to be, you know, brought back in.
Before he even shows up, he drops that bomb.
Yeah.
So it's like, I'm coming to a meeting at your house. And with the young Republicans, let's say. And before I get there, I launch off a tweet that says, I hate all young Republicans and these guys can all just die. You know, so before you even show up, you've already set the tone for don't expect me to do anything positive. Me coming here is basically a stunt. And all I'm going to do is play to my own political base while I'm here.
Right. I mean, the tone has been set and you are, you know, basically, you know, giving a message that you don't really care about those alliances in the yeah. long run. And I mean, he very much said, you know, it's America first and, you know, gave that message, you know, above all else. And I think that particularly when you throw out something like wanting Russia admitted back in without talking to your allies or without giving them any type of advance notice
yeah,
that you're going to go
that I want this on the table.
With that on the table, what type of reaction do you expect? And let's, you know, go back a little bit in history. Russia was you know, part of the group.
Used to be the G8.
Once upon a time, after the Iron Curtain fell, there was this thought process that Russia was going to become a democratic, free market country.
And for about 10 years, they like, well,
Boris Yeltsin,
maybe.
You know, they were...
They were getting there.
They were getting there. And then that changed. And their actions have shown that. You know, their interference in neighboring countries and Crimea and Georgia.
Yeah.
You know, the threats that they've made against the Baltic states. The fact... I mean, we have responded by sending troops into Poland. As a bulwark against the Russian threat. And so to then say, well, we should have them back in.
Is ridiculous.
It completely ridiculous.
It's just ridiculous.
And ironically, Russia is the world's 11th largest economy now. Nope. So they're not even, you know, number 8, number 9. Well, and they have no shared values with the rest of those
countries.
If we're
lining up who should be 8th, should be China.
Right.
I mean, we need to get China into that group.
Economically,
absolutely. We need to get them to exert pressure on them economically, socially. You're right. Russia can be in a next wave that comes. What Trump is an absolute genius at is takes a huge complicated issue like trade, which is very nuanced and can be difficult to understand. And he pulls one or two stats out and he just presents them in a way that lacks any real form of context.
Yes.
But makes you believe, that reinforces his issue, that America is getting screwed. One is that there's a pick whatever country and whatever billion you want. We have a $60 billion trade deficit with Canada. I think what most people think is that means Canada, we write Canada a check for $60 billion each year. I don't think most people understand that, number one, it's an imbalance of trade, of goods going back
imports,
and forth
exports.
Between countries. Absolutely.
Exactly.
So it's not as this isn't a dollar thing. It's not like at the end of the year, we sit down and total up the books and it's like, oh, damn it, Brandon, you got me again. I took more of your goods than me. I owe you $68 billion. And I think that's how he kind of frames this argument all the time.
And it's perspective, because before we had these trade agreements in place, we weren't exporting as much. And so to say, yeah, we have a deficit, that's true. But if you go many years back, we were exporting much less. So really, we are realizing a lot of value from this.
And having a trade deficit doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad relationship for your country or for the economy.
Right.
I think he's using the word deficit and trade. He's putting them together in a way that lacks context and explanation. And he just keeps hitting that over and over and over again politically.
Well, and he's neglecting to mention he wants to focus solely on tariffs or, you know, what he considers unfair trade deals.
Yeah.
The fact that, you know, we as a country subsidize our own industries to a great degree.
Absolutely.
And that is left out of the equation. So you can't make this out to be that it's one-sided, because it's not.
I heard somebody too say all he ever talks about is goods. Services, mm-hmm. when you put that into the mix, balances a lot of this out. So once again, even the numbers he's throwing around lack context to really what is the economic relationship between these countries.
Oh, absolutely.
So is NAFTA going away? I mean, he's talked about NAFTA getting away from NAFTA from day one. He's talked to these folks. Apparently, since he's been president, they've been in some sort of renegotiation cycle with NAFTA. Does he just finally stand up and say, NAFTA's done, we're pulling out, and try to renegotiate, or just say all tariff trades are off?
I don't see that happening. I think, you know, mainly because I think the effects are too detrimental. And I think that here and there, he's been fairly inconsistent on that. But you've seen some, pushback and kind of withdrawing and saying, okay, we're going to take a look at this a little bit more. So you're not going to have him just pull the rug out from under NAFTA and say, we're going to completely start from scratch. I think he's going to look at ways to chip away at that and force concessions by Canada and by Mexico. And go that route. But the problem is Republicans in Congress and the president are already hearing from farmers, and they're hearing
from
major industries.
They're scared right now.
Exactly. Right. Absolutely. Here in the crossroads. I mean, Kansas City, we are a center for transportation logistics.
Ma'am.
I mean, major trade route in terms of trucks transporting goods between Canada and Mexico. We have a lot of industries here that would be immediately impacted if that were the case. And so that blowback is going to be pretty harsh.
It's odd, too, that so most Americans under the tax cut got a very small amount put back into their paycheck. Well, this whole trade tariff war is going to take that right back out. If you got an extra $1,200 or $800 a year in tax relief, we keep messing around with the trade situation and we launch a full on trade war, you'll easily make up that tax break in what you're going to pay for consumer products.
Oh, absolutely. And I think on par, I think the tax reform was good. And I think reducing corporate taxation rates to be competitive with other Western nations was critical. But yeah, you offset all of that in terms of, renegotiating all of these trade agreements potentially. And so the economic impact, if this were to go through and it were to happen before the election, could completely, ruin this economic message that Trump keeps.
You talked to a lot of folks every week about politics. You're active in the Republican Party. Do you think your average American voter can piece these things together over the next couple of years? Is Trump going to make the 2020 election and the issues so complicated that he's just going to shout, "America's great again, look what I did," and that's going to be, for the second time, able to take him to the presidency? Do you think the American voters through the Midwest, which is really, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Florida, is really going to decide this? Do you think folks can piece together some of these nuanced points that we're talking about to be able to say, okay, I see through some of this rhetoric and some of this branding and some of what he does, and here's how this really has impacted me, and here's how I'm going to cast my vote? Are we just going to shout MAGA again and just have at it?
I think they can sort through it all, but I think there has to be a little bit of pain first. I think they have to feel the impact directly. Or they have to hear from friends and neighbors that are involved in ranching and farming out in Western Kansas to, say, hey, this is going to impact my livelihood. This is a bad thing.
Yeah.
And I think that is what will change minds. Trump's strategy is pretty simple. I mean, he would prefer everything being 140 characters and less, and that
Absolutely.
Would be the messaging. He doesn't prefer, long policy discussions or getting into the weeds.
He's not going to.
Right. I mean, it's about oversimplifying every step of the way.
Love him, hate him, you have to give him some credit that he knows how to brand, and he knows how to take big things, distill it down to a thing, and he has no shame with saying on message with that thing, even if it proves to be absolutely wrong. He'll just keep at it over and over and over again.
Right. But I think the resistance he runs into, particularly with NAFTA, is the fact that the world has changed so much since the mid-90s when these NAFTA was negotiated.
Absolutely.
We are much more interdependent, interconnected,
You just don't uncouple trade with Mexico and Canada.
Not without an economic impact, without pretty dire results.
So let's talk our final topic. You and I were prepping up for this. I talked about there's been this delusion on my side of the team, on Democrats, that the Republicans are going to help us out at some point, and there's going to be this awakening on the Republican side to what the damage that Donald Trump is doing and potentially can do to the United States, and they are going to lead this charge to at least level set him and at least be a check to not only his presidential power, but also to just the way he goes about doing business. And this was how the two sides were going to kind of come together to make this situation workable. I think after this week with the Korean summit, and to your point, the Republican reaction to that, we talked about Mark Samford in South Carolina lost a primary election to a Trump-backed candidate, with the only thing really that going against him is that he had bashed Trump in the mildest of terms.
He dared to criticize.
He dared mildly criticize. Bob Corker came out today and said, I guess the Republican Party is just a cult at this point. Paul Ryan, was it today or yesterday, feigned he had no opinion on Scott Pruitt, the EPA. He hadn't really followed it and really didn't really spend any cycles thinking about it. I think from my side of the fence now, it's pretty clear that day of the Republicans kind of lifting the veil and helping in this resistance to Trump, that's not going to happen.
Right. Most Republicans that are up for re-election have made a political calculation that it's in their best long-term interest to just stand with the president and bite their tongue and not criticize because they are deathly afraid of being primaried.
Yep.
They have hedged their bets on being able to win their primary and win in November. But again, that's a big political risk, and they're risking a lot of capital, especially in the swing districts, whether or not they can survive. Yeah.
Isn't it true that it's not, when I think back of Trump and the type of candidates that run in primaries, they're candidates you really can't do anything with because they don't play by the traditional set of rules. They don't care in some states if they're labeled as racist. There's the one guy in Virginia that's just
Corey Stewart,
just
openly, defender of the Confederacy.
Absolutely,
you know, pals around with white nationalists.
So they don't really care about that. They've learned from Trump. The truth is what I tell you it is. You can lie without any real repercussions. So if you and I were running against each other for a political office and you just came out and said, listen, I'm going to go full on Trump, I would be frightened because it's like, well, what do I do? I can't produce any facts. You're just going to lie all the time.
Right.
And you really don't care.
Well, Craig, I've never seen anything like it. I've been watching some of these primaries state by state
where
horrifying. The pro-Trump candidates are, you know, basically stating, I will be more loyal to the president.
Absolutely.
I will be his right. I don't recall a time where this was ever the case. And I think back to when George W. Bush was president and there were primaries that happened and the policy of the party would be to support the incumbent in the primary typically. But President Bush went around and campaigned with Republicans of all stripes, even those that disagree with him on major policy issues.
Yeah.
There wasn't this vibe that who's more loyal to the president and I'm going to be the most loyal and he's insufficiently loyal. I have never heard the word loyal thrown around so much in my entire life when it comes to politics. And that's taken on a whole new tone with this
you're
president.
Right. And I think this is what's got the Democrats. The Democrats have everything going from them from a historical perspective with the midterm. Every party that grabs all three, the midterms are always a level set. And I think they kind of just expected that to happen. And then when Trump starts out, you know, his first 4 or 5 months, he's down in the low 30s. Charlottesville, I mean, this is going to be a layup. Not only are we going to take the House where conditions are favorable, we're going to ride to the Senate too. Fast forward three, four months, I don't know if that's really going to happen anymore. I think we'll take the House just because there's so many things working.
I think
our
the
favor,
dynamics still favor,
but it's going to be a squeaker.
I think the dynamics still favor the Democrats to take the House. If I had to predict today, it would be somewhere between like 12 to 19 seats would be their margin. And you have to remember though that the House races, each one of those is, you're looking at 435 individual races and a lot of factors that go into that. And so I think typically we get very hung up on national polls and presidential approval rating, but you know, we have the past electoral history to look at. A president, both of our past presidents, if you go back to Obama and Bush and Clinton, all three, at this point in their presidency, lost their party seats.
Yeah, absolutely.
And lost many. And so I think, yes, the dynamics still favor the Democrats to retake the House. The Senate seems to be out of reach. That was always going to be very tough. And if they were going to take the Senate, it was going to be by a vote or two. And those seats are just in states that really aren't in play. And I would also add that if the reason that the Republican resistance is non-existent, you have over 40 House Republicans that have announced their retirements already.
Yeah,
most
absolutely.
Of those House Republicans are moderate to centrist Republicans in swing districts. Those were the people who were more likely to disagree or criticize the president. They've thrown up their hands and they're like, I'm done. I just don't want to have anything to do with this. So even if the Democrats have control of the House after all this, the Republican caucus is going to be much more rigid, much more pro-Trump, much more less likely to diverge with him on any policy issue because those members that were are all leaving in droves. So it's going to be, even that dynamic is going to be very different next year.
That night in November is going to be, it's going to be, for me, it'll be a nail biter. I think we'll pull it out, but we've talked about, you know, this is the most confused as an American I think I've ever been. And this is the least I've ever felt I know about politically where we're at, what we're doing, why we're doing it, and where we're going. We could win 40 seats in the House and ride a typical wave and be cool. We could not gain it. Nothing at this point would surprise me because you just don't know what's it's hard to get a feel for what's actually out there. You know, Mike tensed up all the time in the pod when it's like, okay, ladies, you college educated white women were the third rail that nobody saw voting for Trump. We knew evangelicals, we knew white men, we knew he would carry those and carry those big. Why President Trump is sitting in the Oval Office right now is 54% of white suburban educated women voted for him. How does that hold? That can't hold.
No, and I think you have to put that in perspective. That was against an opponent who had extremely high unfavorables, high unpopularity. That was in the context of the FBI investigation and debacle that unfolded. And all of that had an impact. And I've said for the longest time, if the Democrats had had any other candidate that didn't have the last name Clinton, that election would have been very different.
I agree.
And they did not. And that therein lies the danger. And we talked a little bit about this in terms of Democratic leadership. Democrats need new leadership. They cannot just have Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, who are part of that old system, who are not even effective communicators for your party on any level. And I can't, you know, reinforce a message to save their lives.
I've said it before and I've said it again. We got to run Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi has a history of getting legislation passed. Nobody can take that away from her. Nancy Pelosi was also, I believe, almost in her 70s. This makes me want to scream. Barbara Boxer won her primary. She's 88. She could be 94 by the time she comes out of the Senate.
You mean Dianne Feinstein?
Yeah, but Feinstein. I'm sorry. Yeah. Boxer was the other female that won. Boxer's not there anymore, right?
She's not.
She's not. Okay.
Carmella Harris.
They both got elected at the same year.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Boxer's place. Yeah.
So my point is, if you're looking at the world right now as a Democrat and you're kind of saying that we are going in the wrong direction, isn't there, even for somebody who's my age, that there's a natural reaction to say, and what is turning over the keys to somebody in their 80s or 70s? Bernie Sanders is in his mid 70s. Joe Biden. I love Joe Biden, but Uncle Joe, it's just not there. It's not
past his prime. Yeah.
If you want to talk about somebody who's had some wonky issues with women from time to time, made a few off color comments. The environment may have changed so much that he can't run at this point.
Oh yeah. You neutralize that as an issue to a degree. Yeah.
All right, so this is our first podcast with me and Brandon, not Mike. How'd you think it went, Brandon?
I thought it was great. I like it.
They always sound better than you think they do. I'm always surprised that once we put it up, Mike and I have done these, and it's like, God, that sucked. That was awful. But then when you hear it, they always sound better. We've got to get in our flow for off political topics. Mike and I have talked about, you know, loves of different foods, things like that.
Mix it up a little bit.
We'll get into that as we go forward. But thanks for coming out and doing this and helping keep it going.
Oh, thank you. Love it.
Thanks.
Great time.